Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today, we're going back to clinical. No more getting things done. In fact, the next, I don't know, three, four, five episodes will all be purely clinical. We have some great stuff coming up. Today, I want to talk about an update on delayed sequence intubation. We finally published the study, so I think it's time to talk about it on the MCRIT Podcast. Before we get there, I just want to do a quick plug for a free, that's right, absolutely free iBook, a book you read on an Apple device, from my friend and friend of the show, Mike Stone, Ultrasound Maven. These folks are putting out, it looks like it's going to be a series on practical ultrasound, integrating clips and videos and pictures all into an iBook for free. This one is on deep venous thrombosis, and that's a topic that is not part of the standard EM curriculum, and yet something you should be doing for every patient you're scared is dying from a pulmonary embolism, is too unstable for a CT scan. If you find the clot in the leg, that's pretty good proof you know what's causing their problems. This book will take you through the entire status and way of performing DVT ultrasound in the ED. Definitely worth a read, so check it out. Just go to mcrit.org/137 for the link. All right, let's get to the topic at hand. An update on delayed sequence intubation and a little bit on pre-oxygenation as well. So the study was published in the Annals. I'm so happy. It's part of a new cycle of how I think new ideas should be done, which is idea first vetted by the social media community and then published. That's what we did here, and we'll talk about that concept in a wee, but the point is I'm really happy it's finally in print so that the people who are of the traditional medical mindset can no longer say, where the hell is the proof for all this? And they were right to say it, and now the proof is there. Thanks to my co-authors, Seth Truger, Neil Singh, Nelson Wong, Joe Scofie, and Soren Rudolph. So, I talked about this at ASAP. This is essentially a condensed version of that lecture. If you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you already know what delayed sequence intubation is. I'm not going to belabor it. I will say DSI is part of the four concept package that I've been pushing for years as new innovations that will help with airway management in the critically ill patient. The other three besides DSI being CPAP pre-oxygenation, apneic oxygenation, and then using a better device as a new version of the bag valve mask, for instance, a ventilator, a machine actually built to do it instead of our frail, horrible human hands. Before we get to the DSI, let's just talk about an update on pre-oxygenation. Now, when Rich Levitan and I originally put out our state-of-the-art review of pre-oxygenation in the Annals, we were recommending high-flow non-rebreather mask, meaning well beyond the standard 15 liters per minute that we are used to. The 15-liter non-rebreather mask only gave around 60% FiO2, which is dismally poor and will do very, very little to get your patient denitrogenated, and therefore you'll have markedly reduced time till they desaturate. And if you boosted the oxygen on the non-rebreather up to 30 or 40, it got over 90% FiO2, and that was good. But it scared people, and oftentimes, I found that the oxygen tubing would pop off the actual Christmas tree because there's no locking there, and then everyone was scared, and it led to a little more frustration during the intubation because of the loud noise, and we don't recommend that anymore. So this is a definite change from that article. We do not recommend you jam up the non-rebreather to crazy high flows. You won't hurt the patient at all. Trust me, there's holes in the mask, but it's just not elegant. And we want elegance always in our airway management. So here is the new recommendation from Rich and I. Every time you pre-oxygenate with a non-rebreather mask at 15 liters per minute, underneath it should be a nasal cannula at 15 liters per minute. And those two in combination will get the patient well over 90% FiO2. So the new rec, nasal cannula at 15, non-rebreather at 15 for all pre-oxygenations. If that's not cutting it, if their sats aren't coming up, they have shunt physiology, they need CPAP pre-oxygenation, all CPAP pre-oxygenation should be done with a nasal cannula at 15 liters underneath. This allows for ideal pre-oxygenation. It allows for ideal apneic oxygenation. And obviously, if they needed CPAP for pre-oxygenation, they'll need it for apneic oxygenation as well. So the nasal cannula stays on throughout the entire pre-ox period, the entire AppOx period, and then the entire intubation period, and then if you screw up, the entire reox period. So pretty much you want to just have a nasal cannula at 15 liters bonded to the patient's face. I'm not going to belabor that any further. Let's get to the DSI stuff. The classic case of when you'd use DSI is a patient with horrible saturations who you know you want to intubate, and you keep trying to hold on the non-rebreather mask on their face, and they keep slapping it away, telling you, I can't breathe, trying to get up out of the stretcher. And the standard emergency medicine answer to that is you just RSI them. And in fact, if you want to pass your oral boards, at least at this stage, you better say, I would perform RSI and attempt to bag them up during the apneic period, because that's the right answer on the oral boards, at least now. But I never like that answer, because essentially what you're doing is you're hoping and praying that BVM will bring their sats up instead of them continuing to go down. And that's a gamble. I don't like gambling during airway management. It makes me feel out of control. And ED critical care and resuscitation is all about control, always feeling in control. So hence DSI came to the scene. DSI, delayed sequence intubation, breaks up the sequencing of our standard RSI. So instead of giving a induction agent and a muscle relaxant at the same time, we first induce, we keep the patient breathing with airway reflexes, we do anything we need to do in the peri-intubation period, and only then, when we feel great, when everyone in the room feels, yeah, you got this one, do you push your muscle relaxant and let the patient have their apneic period and then intubate them. What could these procedures be? Well, obviously denitrogenation, giving them the 3 minutes without a single interrupted room air breath, 3 minutes of high FiO2 to denitrogenate the lungs and potentially the blood, though that doesn't really matter as much. And you often can't do that in these patients who have agitated delirium. Pre-oxygenation, meaning using either the nasal cannula non-rebreather mask or, in many of these situations, CPAP to get their saturations up well above 95%. Adequate positioning. I want my patient just where I want them during intubation. If they refuse to stay in that position, that is a problem. DSI will fix that problem. Gastric emptying. On that horrible GI bleeder, they're cirrhotic, they have a belly like protruding out a good foot and a half from their spine, I'd very much like to get an NG tube in there and suck out as much of the blood as possible. Sometimes you get like 3 suction canisters full. Sometimes patients don't like things being stuck in their nose when they're already having severe shortness of breath. DSI. And then the last one, the most underappreciated, but maybe one of the most important, is just calming down the situation for the allowance of a good team briefing, a good discussion amongst everyone. When a patient's yelling and screaming and really just not being happy, then everyone gets distracted by that. No one can concentrate on the prep for intubation, and then it leads to a bad pre-intubation situation. DSI will fix that as well. So what is DSI? Well, if you've not listened to any of the podcast or me talk ever, let me just go through it really quickly. You got a patient, agitated delirium from hypoxemia, from hypercapnia, from whatever medical condition is leading them to require airway management, and you don't like it. So you give them a slow push, because rapid pushes of ketamine will give apnea for about 10 to 15 seconds. So you give a slow push of ketamine. The dose we recommend, 1 mg/kg to start, unless you need to take immediate control of a patient, for instance, one who has pulled a switchblade out of their pocket. But in general, you give them 1 mg/kg. You wait 10, 15 seconds, because that's how quick it takes ketamine to work. And if they're totally chill, lying comfortably on the stretcher, no longer fighting you, then you stop. If not, you give another 0.5 mg/kg, wait 10 to 15 seconds, another 0.5 mg/kg, and you keep doing those 0.5 mg/kg aliquots until the patient is chilled. Now, the beauty of ketamine is they will keep breathing, except if you rapidly push it, and then they will start breathing again 15 seconds later, and they will maintain their airway reflexes. This now allows you to pre-oxygenate the patient with nasal cannula non-rebreather or nasal cannula plus CPAP, depending on the patient's need for it. It'll allow you to put an NG tube if you want. It'll allow you to position the patient. It'll allow you to get everything set up just as you like it. You'll give them a minimum of 3 minutes breathing the high FiO2, and then you'll paralyze with sucks or rock. You'll provide apneic oxygenation, and then intubate safely with a feeling of calm and control. If you want to see that flowchart, that is in the show notes, mcrit.org/137. Now, I mentioned we do this for NG tubes. I mentioned we do this for other reasons, and I'll talk about the study that included all that in just a moment. What I will also say is DSI is not CPAP pre-oxygenation. They work beautifully together, but DSI is not synonymous with that. And many of the patients in our study were done with just pure non-rebreather, and you don't need CPAP necessarily. So that was a big source of confusion when we first started talking about DSI. All right, let's get to the evidence. It was published preprint right now in the Annals, available for free. So definitely check this out if you're interested before they make it pay only. And I already mentioned my co-authors. Thank you again to you guys. I couldn't have done it without you. And what we had is we had 62 patients in a prospective cohort trial. We didn't put it in the paper, but these patients were essentially self-controlled, meaning they were their own control. Why do I say that? Well, here's the deal. The primary outcome was their best saturation we could achieve with normal attempts at pre-oxygenation, holding the mask on their face, begging the patient to chill out, trying to hold down their hands so they don't rip off the mask. What's the best sat we could get? And then after pushing the ketamine, what was their saturation just before pushing the muscle relaxant? So when you think about that, we gave it our best shot in the normal way of things, and then we saw how much better we could do after ketamine dissociation, and that was our primary outcome. You could go to the show notes to see the reasons these patients were intubated, but it's the standard stuff: pneumonia, asthma, pulmonary edema, blah, 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 blah. And you could also see the type of respiratory failure or situation they had that made us want to intubate them. And we divided that into type 1, oxygenation failure, type 2, ventilatory failure. And then the third situation, of course, is airway protection for a patient who's oxygenating and ventilating, but we were worried they'd lose their airway. And most of these patients were oxygenation failure. About a third of them were airway protection, and only a few were ventilatory. And that makes sense because, honestly, for ventilatory issues, BiPAP, non-invasive positive pressure, has really taken the prominent role. We don't generally need to intubate those patients anymore. And then the reasons for DSI. 31% of the patients, couldn't tolerate the non-rebreather mask. 63% because they couldn't tolerate non-invasive because the non-rebreather wasn't cutting it. And then 6% because we wanted to place that nasogastric tube. All right, so what happened to these patients? Well, there's a beautiful diagram for David Schreiger we put in the study, and you can find that in the show notes. And I have a couple other diagrams as well, or I should say figures because they're actually graphs. But essentially, the outcomes were all but two of the patients either improved their SATs or stayed at the 100% in the case of denitrogenation they started at. Two patients dropped their SAT 2% each. Both of those were well over the 90% mark after DSI. And the group that we had predetermined before doing the study as really being important, though, is what I really took from this study. There were 32 patients whose saturations starting out were less than 93%. These are the patient group that Dan Davis has classified as at high risk of critical desaturation during the intubation. These guys are the ones who drop when they already start off low. And so of those 32 patients, every single one of them increased their saturations, and all but two of them increased their saturations to greater than 93%. So those are the ones I really think we made a situation of goodness with DSI. There were no complications. Two patients avoided intubation, and we took great pains in the study to say we don't recommend you using DSI to avoid intubation, but you probably can. It's just on you, not on me, if you screw it up. And the classic case, the case in this study of those patients, was the horrible asthmatic came in, they were barely moving air, and you know that if you just get them on some non-invasive to push the nebs in, they'll probably do okay, but they weren't tolerating it. And after the ketamine, they tolerated it beautifully. They woke up from their dissociation 20 minutes later, and the clinicians involved thought they looked so beautiful they didn't intubate them. Instead, they admitted them, and they were watched. None of those patients got intubated, and they went home. So there you go. It's only two patients, though, in the study. We've since done a handful more, but if you do it, it's on you, not on me. Now, the last thing I'll talk about is, what if something goes wrong? What if the patient gets an emetogenic effect from ketamine? Well, ketamine's emetogenic effect in adults is post-emergence. So the only patients this would matter in is the ones you decided not to intubate. I'm not recommending you don't intubate, so it's not really an issue. If you did think it was a clever idea not to intubate, we usually would give them antiemetics, and we'd be prepared for them to puke when they woke up. But there is no periprocedural emesis effect in adults that I could find anywhere in the literature or in my own experience or the experience of my friends, so I'm not worried about it so much. Can you place non-invasive on a patient with the altered mental status of DSI? And the answer to my mind is yes, if it's ketamine. The answer is probably yes, regardless if you're carefully watching the patient, which is what you do in DSI. But with ketamine, I think definitely you can. But you don't leave the room. You sit there for the 3 minutes while they're pre-oxygenating on the BVM with a PEEP valve or the non-invasive machine or the ventilator mask, and you watch them. And I think that's just fine. And our study, I think, bore that out. What if the patient's hypertensive or tachycardic? This is a question that needs an answer. We did not give any insanely tachycardic or hypertensive patient ketamine in this study. My belief, not the proof, but my belief is that if you did give ketamine to those patients, their vital signs would actually get better. That's been my experience, is that when they're already in sympathetic surge, ketamine makes their vitals better, not worse. Someone needs to study this. Min Lekang, I'm looking at you, brother, or any of the folks that are using this on patients with agitated delirium. Someone just needs to publish what happens to their vitals before and after ketamine, because I really believe that if we publish that paper showing that their vitals get markedly better, ketamine would no longer be prohibited in the patient with profound acute pulmonary edema, systolic of 190, and you know a crazy high pulse rate, or that patient who's floridly psychotic and fighting you and you need to get them brought down and you're going to manage their airway. But the study's not out there. So we went for other agents, which brings us to the next question. Can I do this with other meds? Can I do this with propofol? Can I do this with etomidate? Can I do this with midazolam? And the answer is, I'm sure you probably could. I just don't know what that dose is, because the beauty of ketamine is in a critically ill patient, there's still an enormous dose range of safety. In fact, I don't know what the upper limit of safety is for ketamine, because when they've done studies of a 100-fold overdose, patients still do great and they keep breathing. For something like propofol, where we have a relatively wide range of safety in a patient we're putting a shoulder or a hip in, I don't know what that range is for critically ill patients, especially ones with poor cardiac output or hypovolemia or other issues, because there very well might be an overlap between the patient's agitated delirium being fixed and them getting apneic. And that's been my experience, is that the older the patient, the sicker the patient, the smaller the margin of safety is for a drug like propofol or etomidate. And so I don't know. Maybe. There was a great bottom line review of the paper, and one of the folks there, Steve Matthau, was commenting that, can't we do this propofol? And maybe Steve could. I don't think I can. So that's my answer to that. What other meds have we looked at? Dexmedetomidine seemed ideal for this, except that you can't get it in quickly. It has to be loaded over 10 minutes, and even then, it takes a while for them to really chill out. And so it may have potential in just a small group of patients. I don't think it's good. The agent that is really, really what I want for the patients who have high blood pressure and high pulse rates and works beautifully is droperidol. Drope will chill the patient out. They're still aware, so you have to give them an induction agent at the same time you are pushing your muscle relaxant, but it definitely will work for DSI. Only problem is it has disappeared in the United States. It's no longer being manufactured. There's no one doing it because it was bought out by the makers of an atypical injectable antipsychotic, and then they just stopped making it, which is evil. I think there is definitely a role for someone to open a company that just makes generic drugs, sell them at a markup. I mean, by all means, charge a bunch more money than you would for a standard generic, but not as much as you charge for a brand name drug, and you can make a profit. Now, I don't think, because of the barriers to entry, anyone who's listening to this is going to do that, but gosh, I wish they would. Or make it a government thing to make these generic drugs in the United States. That would be a great way to employ people. It would definitely make a profit, and everyone would be happy, but probably the pharmaceutical lobbies will prevent that from ever happening. But the point is, if droperidol comes back, I think it'll work. Last thing to talk about, what about the patient that goes apneic? Well, again, ketamine shouldn't do that in adults, and we've not seen case reports of that happening except for one where there was a whole bunch of cladded issues. And again, it can be for 15 seconds if you push it rapidly, but then they all start breathing again. But what if you were the first case of DSI apnea? Well, what you do when you do DSI is you have every piece of equipment, every medication you'll need for the intubation and the post-intubation, every difficult airway equipment, all of your setup with BVM suction already and set before you push the ketamine. You don't leave the room. You don't go see a chest pain patient. You chill out there in the room while they're getting their ketamine-induced pre-oxygenation. And if they did go apneic, push your sucks or push your rock and intubate the patient. You are in the exact same situation as if you had RSI'd them. Ketamine-induced laryngospasm in adults, I don't think this situation actually exists. People have told me it has, and every time in the back of my mind is, no, actually, you just need to better position the airway. But let's say you were the case who had ketamine adult laryngospasm, by all means, then just push your muscle relaxant. It's exactly the same as if you had RSI'd the patient. So DSI is just procedural sedation, and the procedure is pre-oxygenation. I think Min LeKong is going to have me on his Farm podcast to talk about the intricacies of this further. So if you have additional questions, put them in the comments of this show and I'll answer them on Min's show. I hope if you haven't given DSI a try, you give it a shot and see what you think. And if you have any problems or you just want to tell me that it worked out great for you, then put it in the comments of this episode. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.